Welcome to Meaningful Judaism, where we try to answer why we do what we do in Jewish life. In this podcast, we search for meaning by diving deep into the Torah text. Meaningful Judaism is a product of Aleph Beta Labs, and I'm your host, Imu Shalev. Aleph Beta scholar Beth Lesh is back with me for part three, the final part of our Kashrus series.
Hey, everyone.
So, Beth, we already did an episode about not eating milk and meat together. We talked about whether we're even allowed to eat meat. And we talked about Shechita and Kisui Dam. What's left for us to discuss is which animals we're allowed to eat and which we're not allowed to eat.
Exactly. You take a pig, you shecht it according to, you know, the laws of kosher slaughter, and you are careful not to mix it with milk, it is still never going to be kosher. And not just pigs, you know, but pigs are the most famous of the non-kosher animals.
Right. And I feel like we should talk about the pig, right? Like, why can't we eat bacon? And I'm not suggesting that we all really badly want to eat bacon, but I'm also not suggesting it, right? Like, I grew up in a pretty big Jewish community. And it's not like there was a lot of bacon around everywhere, but on TV, right? Like, remember those commercials with, like, the sizzling bacon?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. It drops down from the ceiling onto the bun, right?
It looked so good. I felt like I could almost smell it. And, like, in all of the cooking shows, one of the cheats that the chefs use is they add bacon to everything. A savory dish with bacon, or like a muffin with bacon, or a donut with bacon. I don't understand how that works, but everyone agrees on TV that bacon makes everything better.
So I personally don't have such a craving the way you're describing it. First of all, there's a lot of bacon substitutes. I kind of feel like if God is asking me not to eat pig, there's plenty of other things to eat. I can not eat pig. So I don't really struggle with this restriction. It's more I just find myself being curious, like, why doesn't God want us to eat bacon? Like, God doesn't want us to eat yummy foods? Is that it? How did God decide that cows are kosher but pigs aren't? Like, what's the reasoning there? Is there a reasoning there? And Imu, since this is an episode of Meaningful Judaism, I'm guessing that you have a theory about the meaning behind why some animals are kosher and others aren't.
I do have a theory. What I want to do is go on this journey of discovery through the Torah to find it. But there is something important that I want to mention up front, which is that the theory is a little more speculative than what we've shared in the other Meaningful Judaism episodes.
Okay, but you're going to show me textual evidence to prove your argument?
Oh yeah, I'm going to show you textual evidence, but I'm not sure about that word prove. I think the evidence is suggestive, and I've built the best theory that I possibly could. I personally find it very exciting and persuasive, but I think I'd leave it up to you and to the listeners to decide if it's something compelling and meaningful to you as well.
Thank you for your honesty. With that caveat on the table, let's dive in.
So the way I want to do this, Beth, is to kind of share with you what were the pieces I saw. Like, how did I put this theory together? And just recreate my journey, walk you through it step by step. I was looking for the deeper meaning behind kosher and non-kosher animals. And I went to the biblical text, and the place that I thought to go was Parshat Shemini, the section in Leviticus where we learn about which animals are kosher and which aren't. And so I'm looking around for some sort of explanation, and nothing.
Right. I mean, it's just lists of, like, these are the animals you can eat, these are the animals that you can't, these are the signs, you know, choose cud, cloven hooves, but it doesn't seem to say why.
Exactly. So I'm just reading the verses carefully, kind of scouting for some sort of clue, and something does jump out at me, or maybe the absence of something jumps out at me. It's a word that I'm fully expecting to see in this section, and it's not there, which I actually found really shocking. That word that's not there is kosher.
The kashrut section of the Torah doesn't use the word kosher?
Yep. The Torah never says pigs aren't kosher. Actually, the word kosher doesn't appear in this chapter or anywhere in the Chumash, the five books of Moses. Kosher, what it means is suitable or proper. And the rabbis do use that word to describe permitted foods, but it's not how the Torah characterizes things at all. Instead, the Torah uses a totally different term, or a pair of terms, tamei and tahor, which are usually translated as impure and pure, although it's very tricky to translate. What the Torah says is, et hachazir tamehu lachem lo tochelu. Right? The pig is tameh. He is impure, and you shouldn't eat it.
That's really interesting. Because I associate the words tameh and tahor with all kinds of other laws that have nothing to do at all with what we can and can't eat.
So here I am reading this chapter looking for clues, and to me it's like, well, maybe that's a clue. We're in Vayikra. Vayikra is the book about Toma and Tara. We're going to go on and read about all kinds of other things that are Tameh and Tahor. So I said to myself, it really looks like the Torah's reasons for why we can't eat certain animals is bound up intimately with these concepts of Toma and Tara.
It's like the Torah is telling us that if we want to understand why we can eat cows but can't eat pigs, it's a matter of Tuma and Tahara. And we have to understand those concepts.
Exactly. So what I wanted to do is something that our listeners probably didn't expect when they hit the play button on an episode on Kashrus, but we're going to pivot a bit and deep dive into the concepts of Tuma and Tahara. We need to do that if we're going to understand Kashrus.
Okay, so Imu, that makes a lot of sense, and I am game to talk about Tuma and Tahara, but we will get back to Kashrus, right? Like, we'll get back to this question of which animals we can and can't eat.
Yeah, I promise we'll get back there. And I hope that when we'll be ready to see some things that we weren't able to see before. So let's start with the basics. Beth, what do you know about Tuma and Tahara?
When you are tamei, you're in a state of tuma. It means that you can't do certain holy things. You can't bring a korban, a sacrifice. You can't eat a korban. You can't visit the mikdash, the temple. If you're in the state of tahara, that's the opposite, then you can do those things. And there are these various purification rituals that allow a person to move from the state of tuma to the state of tahara.
How does a person become tamei in the first place?
Lots of ways. The classic example is when you touch a dead body, you become tameh. Also, if you get sarat, this weird skin disease, you're also tameh. Certain other diseases, if a woman has her period, when a woman gives birth, a man who has a seminal emission, there's this whole long list.
Okay, good. So those are the basics of somebody who's tameh and tahor, but let's get into the translation of those words itself. Typically, people translate them as purity and impurity. But as I said a minute ago, it's pretty tricky to translate it that way.
To slap this label of impure on someone, it suggests that they sinned, that they did something that they shouldn't have done. But that's not the case at all. I mean, you get tameh from touching a dead body, right? So if you are preparing a dead body for burial, that's a mitzvah, but that makes you tameh. When you get your period, you didn't do anything wrong. It's natural. It's out of your control, but it still makes you tameh. There is reason to think that, you know, tzaraat is a case where you did something wrong to bring it on, but most tuma does not result from prohibited actions. So when you look into it, it seems that being tameh, it's not that it's spiritually unideal, like, you know, you shouldn't have become tameh. It's more like, okay, if you are in this state, then don't do these things. It's morally neutral. And when we translate tuma as impurity, it doesn't quite seem to capture that.
So what's the essence of tuma? Like, if the essence of tuma isn't that you've sinned, you know, and you get like a slap on the wrist and you can't do certain holy things, then what is the essence of tuma? We have all these different categories. If you do this, you become tameh. If you do this, you become tameh. But what ties them together? Have you heard any answers that speak to that?
I've heard an answer that is sometimes attributed to Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, although I think Rav Hirsch's formulation is a bit more nuanced than like the popular conception. But anyway, the idea is that tuma is the state of having encountered mortality.
Good.
It's a brush with death.
Beautiful. We at Parsha experimented brush with mortality. So
brush with mortality. I was mixing.
Encounter with mortality, brush with death, brush with mortality. They all work.
Encounter with brushes.
Right. The idea is that tuma somehow has to do with death. That when we confront death, it puts us in a state of tuma. And there's no moral issues with that, but somehow, you know, God's presence doesn't tolerate our brushes with mortality, so we have to go outside the camp, do some ritual, bring us back in when we can be in our more pure state.
I appreciate that definition, because if you think about some of the examples of people who are tame, one of the classic examples is someone who's literally come into contact with a dead body. So that one's pretty obvious. But even all the other examples, you know, a woman who has her period, in what sense is that a brush with mortality? Oh, but when you think about it, oh, the period, it's like, oh, it was the potential for life, and that egg, you know, and the uterine lining is leaving your body. So kind of with all of the examples, you can squint a little and all of a sudden see how they are, in fact, expressions of that same kind of phenomenon, which is cool.
Yeah, it is. I think it's a much better definition than pure and impure.
Yeah.
But there are still some challenges with that definition. And I think these challenges, I don't mean to pile on questions, but I think they're actually clues to an even more nuanced understanding of tuma and tara. So let me level a couple of them and make us a little uncomfortable.
Ooh.
So one of my first issues, you know, with the definition of tuma being a brush with mortality or, you know, relating to death in some way, is God is the source of all life, right? But he's also the source of all
death.
He's the source of all death.
He's also the source of all death. So why would it be problematic? Why would God and death not mix? Why would it be that if you've had a brush with death that you somehow can't be in God's presence?
Right. That part doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. As if like God finds death somehow offensive. He made up death.
Okay, so you're not doing what I thought you were going to do, which is like, wait, if you think about one of these cases, it doesn't quite fit. You're saying like, no.
I'll get there. That's where I'm going to go next.
Okay. Okay, cool.
Yeah, that next thing that you're talking about is, and I think this is the most commonly brought up exceptional case, is the case of the Yoledes, right? A woman who gives birth. Is tame, and she's not just a little tame. She's, you know, one of the longest cases of tuma. That case doesn't make a lot of sense if you see tuma as being a brush with mortality.
Which is not to say that if someone paid you $1 million, you couldn't come up with a reason.
And we did, by the way. Like when David Block and I recorded our piece in Parsha Experiment back in 2016, we have a reason, and it's not just our reason. Many commentators say the same thing. They argue that a woman who is in childbirth is, you know, it's a very dangerous situation, especially.
Yeah, that's something that we've lost touch with.
And we even haven't, by the way. It's still dangerous. And so, sure, like you can argue that it is a brush with mortality because it's a dangerous thing to do. On the other hand, she brought a life into the world.
Yeah.
So I'd expect it to either cancel out or cancel out some of the days of tuma. Like, why is she sitting in like the most tuma of like anybody?
I appreciate these questions. The conversation that usually gets had about tuma and tara is like, oh, you think tuma and tara means pure and impure. Wrong. That's not sophisticated enough. Let me re-educate you. What it actually means is it's a brush with mortality. It's ethically neutral. Da, 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 da. So you're climbing on top of that and you're being like, wrong. Let me give you a more nuanced version.
It's this. I don't think I'm going to declare wrong. I think tuma certainly is about a brush with mortality, but I think that there's some nuance there. And that's what I'd love to argue. All right, I still have two more objections to this theory.
To the tuma as a brush with mortality theory.
Right. So we talked about how it doesn't quite add up that God has a problem with death. God is the source of death. And we talked about the Yoledes, the one who gives birth, as another objection.
What else you got?
Here's another one. When you think about how kosher and non-kosher animals fits into this, the theory doesn't quite work. We saw in the verses that we read in the Torah, don't eat these animals, they're tame. Now, if tuma is caused by an encounter with death, then the Torah seems to be saying, don't eat these animals because there's something deathy about them. I have a problem with that, though, which is, what do we do to our tahor animals in order to eat them?
Oh, we kill them. So what I think I hear you saying is, if the essence of tuma is that there's something deathy about it, and then the Torah comes along and says, don't eat animals that are tameh. So presumably the Torah wants us to stay away from deathiness somehow when we're eating animals. But we don't do a very good job at all of staying away from deathiness when we eat animals, because in order to eat any animal, we have to kill it.
Exactly. So if a ham, which is a dead pig, is tame, and a hamburger, which is a dead cow, is tahor, it's way too simple to say that tame means deathy and tahor means lifey.
Oh, that is a good objection.
And my final objection is actually about the word tahara, not really so much about the word tuma, right? If tuma is death, then the opposite of that word should be
life. I know this one.
Right? Maybe it's tuma and chiyus, right? Tuma and something lifey, but the word that's used is tahor or tahara, which, you know, we classically understand as pure or clean or something like that. And I don't think that's the best definition of that word. And I actually was reading a story that we did read in Meaningful Judaism before that I noticed actually might shed light on a better definition of the word tahara and will hopefully give us a better understanding of what tuma and tahara mean in general. I'd love to take you to that story.
I'm just going to remind you that you did invite me here for a kashrus discussion, so I'm not leaving until I get an answer about kosher animals. But yeah, if you are saying that studying this story is going to help us get there, then I trust you. Let's do it.
So the story is in the strangest of places. There's this encounter where Moshe, Aaron, Nadav, and Avihu go up a mountain to meet God. And it says they see God, whatever that means. So I'm going to actually have you read and translate some verses with me. Come to Exodus 24, verse 9.
I'm coming. Vaya'al Moshe va'aharon Nadav ve'avihu v'shivim mizikne Yisrael. They've gone up. Who's gone up? It's Moshe, Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, Aaron's sons, and the 70 elders. And Vayir'u et Elokei Yisrael. They saw the God of Israel. That's already trippy.
Yep.
V'tachas raglav, and underneath his feet, kema'aseh livnas hasapir. It looked like something made out of sapphire stone, ucha etzem hashemayim latohar, and it was like the essence of the sky. Latohar, tahara.
There's that word. We'll hang out and translate that word in a second. But just to follow through here, what's happening is there's a rock or something carved, and it's like this big brick of sapphire under God's feet. Again, we don't need to understand what any of this really means. But the text is trying
to... That's a relief, because I don't understand what it means.
The text is trying to give us some adjectives or some sense to understand what that rock looked like. And it says that it was so blue. It was like the sky in its tohar. It's not hard to translate in context. What would you say that word means? It doesn't mean not death.
Right. Okay, so it was so blue, it was like the very essence of the sky regarding its, the word that's coming to mind is clarity.
Yeah, exactly. Like if we're talking about a gem, it's rated in terms of its clarity, right? So this sapphire, it was so clear. It was like clear blue sky. And I think we can even do one better than clarity. What I would say is transparency. You have a sapphire. If it has imperfections, if it has something that kind of stops the light in passing through it, it's going to look more cloudy. But the text is saying it was so perfectly pure in its color because the sapir, the sapphire, it had its tohar. It was the quality of clarity. What gives a gemstone its clarity is its transparency, the extent to which light can perfectly pass through that stone. Mm-hmm. First of all, you with me so far?
I'm with you. It's clear. What you're saying is clear. Just some tahara humor for you.
Everyone could use a little more tuma tahara humor.
It's funny because we started out by rejecting the translation of tahor as pure. But now I'm thinking maybe it's actually not such a bad translation after all. Just not the way that we're used to thinking of that word, right? Like, not pure as spiritually awesome and holy and free from sin, but pure as in there's nothing that's blocking the way. There's nothing that's stopping the light from passing through. You know, like you said, the sapphire was purely blue. It was entirely blue. I think that harmonizes with your transparency idea.
Yeah, I think it does. So once I saw that tahara seems to mean transparency, I started to wonder how that had anything to do with tuma and tahara as I was used to thinking about them. Doesn't tuma have to do with death? How would transparency fit with an understanding of tuma meaning death?
Mm-hmm.
So Beth, like once I got there, let me ask you, what would you do next? What would your first step be as a researcher knowing that the word tahara means clear? What would you do next?
Yeah, I think I would go back to those cases of tuma and tahara in the Torah and say, can I take this definition of tahara, meaning transparency, and can I read it into these cases, and does it make sense?
Yeah, and I feel like the first case you got to visit to see and to play with this is death itself, right? Death is avi avot tatuma. It is the most tameh thing you could possibly get to. So let's say tahara means, you know, transparent or clear. How would that change our definition of tuma and tahara here?
So you're saying, in what sense is a dead body somehow an expression of a lack of transparency? Okay, let me think about that. Transparent means that I can see through to whatever's on the other side. But what would that even mean to be able to see through someone's body?
Yeah, so that's kind of where my mind went when I started thinking about this. Like, what does transparent mean when we're talking about a person? When we looked at Livnat HaSapir, the sapphire stone, transparency there meant that light was passing through a rock.
Right.
It was a very literal definition of transparency,
mm-hmm.
right? You can see through that rock and it was perfectly clear. But if we're going to try and extend this idea of transparency to the cases of tuma and tahara, that like really literal definition.
Yeah, the literal definition is not going to work, obviously.
Right, because that's about light being able to pass through something. Otherwise, like windows would be the most tahor thing in the world, but that's not the way it works.
Right. Okay, so then maybe it's not about something being transparent to light per se. It's about being transparent to something else, letting something else pass through.
If I had to replace light with something else, right? Like a dead body is somehow more opaque, and something that is tahor is more transparent. The thing I'm trying to solve for is transparent to what? What would light be if we were to use that as a metaphor in the context of tuma and tahara?
Oh, so I'm wondering, maybe the light has to do with God. Like maybe there's some element of the divine that was like we could see it in them when they were alive and now we can't see it anymore.
That's where my mind went. Like somehow maybe you don't see the divine in a dead body as much as you do in a living human being. That human is somehow more transparent, not to light, you don't see through them, but to godliness, right? We talked about God as a source of life and death. Well, we can very clearly see God's lifiness in someone when they're alive. They're more transparent, right? That makes a lot of sense to me.
But when we encounter tuma, that lack of transparency, it's as if we can no longer see through the person to the source of where their life originally came from.
Yeah. When we encounter a human being walking around, living, breathing, that to us, you know, is transparent to God's handiwork.
Yeah.
When you see a dead body, it's not always as easy to see, even though objectively they're equally God's handiwork. But to us, to humans, for some reason, one is far more transparently testifies to the divine and the other obscures it.
Mm-hmm.
We were saying, what's God's problem with death? God doesn't have a problem with death, right?
We do.
It's us.
Yeah.
Our ability to continue to see God as the source of life is imperiled when we encounter death.
So the way you're understanding it, tuma arises from human psychology, right? It's mm-hmm. it's subjective. It's when our sense, human beings' sense that God is our source and the source of everything is somehow dimmed. Like our ability to access that truth, that awareness is compromised.
Right. And look, by the way, just to give credit where credit is due, there are other commentators who understand tumah as arising from a psychological reaction.
Mm-hmm.
So that part of the theory is not entirely novel. But what I do think is novel is this transparency piece. The notion of tumah as a lack of transparency to God as our source. And what's also novel is how I arrived at the theory, which is seeing this word tohar in this story, this other section of the Torah, and then kind of following it through.
Mm-hmm. So, Imo, I'm wondering now, if encountering death causes us to somehow like lose touch with the idea that God is the source of life, of everything, really, then it seems as if it would be very, very difficult to actually hold on to that pure awareness of God. Because all of these things that make us tamei, they're everywhere, right? A natural process, like giving birth, getting certain diseases. And that's a little confusing to me because we said before when we were talking about the definition of tumah and tahara that we didn't like the words impure because it felt as if there was some kind of sin involved, some kind of behavior that isn't ideal, and that's not really the case with the kinds of tumah that we were talking about. But I feel like now we're kind of coming back to that same idea, like sort of saying, well, if you're tahor, then you have this utter clarity, this complete awareness of God as the source of everything. But if your vision is kind of being clouded by coming into contact with a source of tumah, then your awareness of God is diminished. Like that to me sounds as if it's not very desirable.
Yeah, I totally hear the question. Once I'm arguing that transparency has all to do with God awareness, it almost feels like we've entered back into the moral dimension. Like, who wants to not be aware of God? That sounds like it's a bad thing.
Yeah.
But I don't think that that's what we're saying. There is no requirement to be tahor all the time, or even to be tahor as much as possible.
And you take that to mean that God doesn't want us to have God awareness all the time?
Yeah, that actually is what I'm saying. Here, there's this analogy that I think might help us with this strange kind of mind-bending notion that God would just be perfectly happy with us not being aware of him all the time, of how perpetual, perfect God awareness could actually be harmful. It could actually kind of, I don't know, like ruin the beauty of the world that God created for us. So let me share this analogy with you.
Okay, this is a little mind-bending, so I'm game for the analogy.
So this idea may seem a little bit Kabbalistic, and if it's compelling, great. If not, you can reject it. But imagine that we are all in a movie. We're in God's film, and God is shining light onto the film and animating us. And you can have an awareness that you're a character in a movie, or you can lose total awareness that you're a character in a movie. When you encounter death and you've lost awareness that you're a character in a movie, death is a horrible and tragic thing. Right? A friend has died. Someone has died. Right? But let's say you, as a character in a movie, have tremendous transparency and clarity, and you realize that God, you know, wrote the screenplay. You're his character. Another character dies. If you are utterly transparent and are nothing other than an emanation of the will of the filmmaker, this is how the story progresses. You can't experience this being is gone. You actually can't experience a sense of loss. There's an awareness of unity and oneness to the entire story. That, I think, on a deep level, perhaps, might be what tahara is. And it's not that God demands of us to be utterly and completely aware and to be tahor at all moments. Us, as characters in the film, are too invested in our separateness in the film as characters. We don't realize it's a film. We're in the land of the story. And we think we have our own homes and our own lives and we're our own characters. But the truth is, we exist as emanations of the filmmaker. That is what being more tahor is like. When you get too invested in the story, that is tameh. You are more opaque.
I have yet to meet the person who is so spiritually enlightened that when faced with a loss of someone who's close to them, that they react with, you know, the equanimity of one who says, ah, I can't feel any loss because I know that we're all just projections of God on the screen in this movie house that call the world. Yeah.
Yeah. But first of all, how interesting of a movie would it be if the characters walked around all the time being like, we are but emanations of the filmmaker, right? There's no plot. There's nothing interesting can happen.
I wouldn't want to see that movie.
Right. And second of all, that awareness, that perpetual clarity, it's not even what God expects of us. We're allowed to actually get caught up in playing our roles. And there's a particular story I have in mind where I think we can see this happening. And it's the story of a tragic death in the Torah. And what's interesting is that the entire Tumah and Tahara section of the Torah seems to be introduced as relating to the story of tragic death.
Well, you're thinking of Nadav and Avihu?
Yeah, I'm thinking of Nadav and Avihu. That story is all about allowances that God makes for Aaron, for his family, to not always engage in purity and clarity of perspective. Moshe actually seems to demand that of Aaron, if you read the story carefully, and Aaron sort of intuits a different way of being, and Moshe and God accept it.
You're saying that in that moment, when two of Aaron's sons have just been killed, and God doesn't expect him to just bounce back and say, like, I'm completely at peace with this. I know that everything comes from God, even death. I accept this. God seems to respect his grief and allow him space.
And what I'm pointing out is that's not just a nice story about how God allows us to grieve. That's the story where Tumah and Tahara are introduced. Like, the rest of the book is a reaction to that story.
What do you mean that's where the laws of Tumah and Tahara are introduced?
Yeah, what I mean is that what we get immediately after the Aharon, Nadav, and Avihu story are the laws of kosher animals. The Torah is teaching about Tumah and Tahara in the context of there's been this great loss and there are going to be allowances made for that loss.
So I really appreciate this framework, Emu, because I'm so used to thinking of Tumah as a restriction, almost a punishment. You can't do X, Y, Z, but it sounds like the lens that you're offering is, oh, maybe there are all of these natural phenomena over the course of our lives. We're going to encounter them. And when we do, it makes sense in those moments that our reaction would be to not be as transparent to God. And God recognizes that and says, oh, why don't you take some time? Like, now is not the best time for you to be getting up and making the valedictory speech in the, you know, in the center of the Beit HaMikdash. Like, why don't you take some time? Take some time to get back to that place. And that's built into the rhythm of our lives.
Yeah.
Okay, Emu, so you've just taken me on this whole textual, theological journey to get at the deeper meaning of Tumah and Tahara. And it's been very cool. But I'm just remembering the way that we got into this. You know, you said most people think Tumah is about a brush with death. But actually, that explanation has some problems. And you raised these four objections. And then you proposed a new way to think about Tahara as transparency. So if I'm going to accept this new way of thinking about Tahara, I want to know, does your theory have an answer for those objections?
It had better. So let's talk about that. So I said that if Tumah just results from a brush with death, then you have to explain to me why God wants us to keep deathy things away from him, away from the temple, given that God is also the source of death.
Right. Okay, but I can do this one. If we understand Tumah not as a brush with death per se, but as the experience of not seeing God as the source of everything, that question melts away.
Yep, that was our first question. And our fourth question kind of melts away too.
What was the fourth question? Oh, yeah. You pointed out that Tahor is the opposite of Tameh. So if Tameh means deathy, then Tahor should mean lifey. But in that story you showed me, it doesn't seem to mean that. It means transparent. So, okay, all right, cool. So that objection is accounted for. You're going to have to explain the Yoletis one to me, because your issue was, why would the Yoletis, the postpartum woman, be tame, be deathy, considering that she just brought a life into the world? So, fine. But if tame doesn't mean deathy, it means not aware of God as the source. I don't know. I'm pretty curious what you're going to say here, Emu, because I would think that a woman who's just given birth has a very strong awareness of God as source. Like, obviously, I can't speak for others, but my personal experience is that I feel really grateful. It's like, you know, thank you, Hashem, for this miracle, this unbelievable gift. So how do you see the Yoletis as being somehow not transparent to the reality of God?
So here's how I think about it, and I admit this is just my theory. God has just brought this new life into the world. And it's sort of like the light of God should be shining through this child, right? This, like, it's tahor, it's clear, it's transparent. Except that in my mind's eye, there's this shadow. There's something standing in between the light of God and the child, and that something is the mother.
Oh, interesting. The God as filmmaker analogy is kind of helpful for me. Like, in other words, when you're the mother who's just given birth, you don't feel like your child is a character in a movie and God is the filmmaker and the creator. You feel like the creator.
Yeah, it's not like somebody else cast to this child and you got to play the role of mom, right? Like, you brought this child into the world.
Yeah.
You know, I obviously have never experienced childbirth and never will, but, you know, women are like demigods. Mm. Like, they have the power to bring life. Adam calls Chava, right? Mm-hmm. Essentially life lady, because she's Eim Kol Chai. She's the mother of everything that lives. And even consider, in her first birth, she has a child. She names that child Cain, which means acquisition, right? Or creation.
Mm-hmm. Like, I've done it. Actually, she says, Kaniti Ish Et Hashem. I've acquired this child. I've created this child with God, almost like an afterthought. Like, the feeling you get from her language is that she's really focused on her own central role in the birth of this child, that she's feeling proud.
Again here, I think Tuma functions as a sort of allowance, which is like, you know what? You can be proud. Like, you put a lot of effort into carrying this child, into birthing this child. I don't think God expects for you in that moment to say, I am tahor. I am perfectly transparent to the source of all life in the world. And I recognize it is not I, it is God who hath done this deed.
Right. A mother can feel that it's a spiritual experience. She can get up after the birth and give the Devar Torah at the, you know, at the Brit or at the Simchat Bat and, like, talk about how close she feels with God and how grateful she is to God. But there's a sense in which, even with that happening, that she's forgetting something about the centrality of what role God is playing in that dynamic.
And I'm not saying that there's any problem with that, and neither is the Torah. The Torah, there is this tension of humanity as little creator. And when we're engaged in creativity, it's like we're gods. And there are mitzvot that rein in that creativity. There are mitzvot that ask you to reconcile your little creativity with that of big creator and nest your act of creation under God's creation. And women are given, you know, this period of time to do that reconciliation.
So really, Tuma doesn't have to be connected to death at all. Like, death shows up in a lot of the cases of Tuma. Death can lead to Tuma, because confronting death can cause us to lose touch with our awareness of God as source. But death isn't the essence of the thing, in your theory, I'm saying. And that's how you can have this case of the Yoledes, who is super duper lifey and is still tummy. There's just one question left, I think, about eating animals. If tameh means deathy, then how could there be such a thing as a tahor dead animal? That doesn't make sense.
Right. I think that's probably the strongest question against the paradigm of tumah as death. if tahor means not deathy, it doesn't make sense. But if tahor means something else, right, if it means transparent to God as source, then we can work with that.
Wait, so a kosher animal is not less deathy than a non-kosher animal? It's somehow more
They're all dead. They're all the same dead.
They're all dead. But it's somehow more transparent to God as source. But what does it mean for an animal to be transparent to God as source? And how are the kosher animals somehow more transparent to God as source than the non-kosher ones?
Yeah, so what you're asking is exactly the question that I think the Torah wants us to ask. Back in Shmini, in Leviticus 11, the Torah explains that if an animal has split hooves and it chews its cud, it is tahor, and therefore we can eat it. So if tahor really does mean transparent, then we should be able to look at these two signs and see how somehow animals with these signs are more transparent to the reality of God. So that's what I want us to look at.
We're finally coming back to kashrus.
We're finally coming back to kashrus.
Yeah, I'm jazzed for that. I don't know how you're going to pull this off, but I'm definitely on the edge of my seat.
Just a caveat before we begin. I admitted at the start of this episode that the material here is a bit more speculative than what we presented in other episodes, and I just want to reiterate that, especially in this part, as we get into the details of the signs.
Got it. Okay, so warning to our listeners, if you find yourself kind of yelling at Emu when you're listening to this part, like, how do you account for this detail, Emu? And you don't know anything about animals, you city dweller. So, Emu, you are on the record being aware that the argument needs some finessing.
The argument has some bona fide holes, but a lot is just that I don't have the space here to get into all of the nuances. But even with that said, I really believe that what I'm about to share is still worthwhile. And the truth is, we actually have an epilogue coming out that's going to get into any of the pieces of the theory that are not tied into neat little bows, so you can stay tuned for that epilogue. Okay. When I was learning this with my chavrusa David Block a few years ago, we noticed something really interesting about these signs. And we're going to get into the science for a bit because I think it's really relevant and really cool. Let's talk about chewing cud. The scientific term for that is that it's a ruminant. And a ruminant are these kinds of animals that have four stomachs. And when a ruminant eats, at first, it barely chews its food at all. The food enters the first compartment of its stomach where it's broken down. And then in the second compartment, the food mixes with saliva and it becomes this thing, this cud. And then the cud comes back up into the animal's mouth. The animal chews it to further break it down. It goes and enters the third compartment where water is absorbed out of the food. And finally, it goes into the last section where it digests its food, much like our own stomachs. Now, why am I telling you this? Ruminants have this elaborate digestion because it allows them to eat things that humans could never dream of eating. Ruminants are always herbivores. They're plant eaters, and they're a very specific type of herbivore, which is unlike many other vegetarian animals who can eat seeds or grains or nuts, just like we can. Mm-hmm. Ruminants primarily eat raw leaves and grasses, which are extremely difficult to digest. Humans cannot eat grass. You would starve. We don't have the ability to break down the sugars that are present.
I mean, not what my 3-year-old thinks, but go on. Interesting. Okay, so you're saying when the Torah says animals that chew its cud, that's a shorthand for saying animals that eat a lot of raw leaves.
A lot of raw leaves and grass specifically, yeah. Let's just quickly talk about split hooves. What are the function of split hooves? Well, hooves are the tip of an animal's toe that's covered by a thick, hard keratin coat. And the point of that hoof is to allow an animal to stand and travel for long periods of time.
Grazing.
If you have an animal with hooves, you know that the terrain is going to be grassy areas. Split hooves, they allow the animals to go even a step further. They can be in grassy pastures and flatlands, but they can actually get extra traction when they're running or jumping on rocky terrain. And that gives them protection because they could be vulnerable to predators when they're out in the plains just grazing. So the split hooves allow them to escape across any terrain. So both of these traits, chewing cud and having split hooves, they're together elements that point to a particular type of animal, a grass and leaf-eating vegetarian.
In other words, we're used to thinking of these two signs as being two completely different things, but actually they really both point to the same kind of animal, the same kind of behaviors, which is that we're talking about herbivores, but not just herbivores, herbivores that eat a lot of grass, that graze over grassy areas for long periods of time.
What's interesting is the Gemara actually makes this same point, but in another way. Masechet Chulin, Daf Nun Tet Amud Aleph, says that there's another way we can tell if an animal is kosher. If you see that the animal does not have upper teeth, meaning pointed teeth, incisors, then you can know for sure that it chews its cud and has split hooves. Why would that be true? Because upper incisors are for ripping through tough materials like nuts or animal flesh. If an animal doesn't have them, it's because its diet consists of things that don't need them. In other words, they eat grasses and leaves. So it seems like the Gemara also thinks that chewing cud and split hooves together point to a certain type of animal, grass-eating herbivores. Consider the diet of these animals in the context of Tumah and Tara. Where does your mind go?
In what sense are animals that have that kind of diet and have those kind of behaviors somehow more transparent to the reality of God or transparent to source than others? Transparent to God, I'm struggling a little bit there, but when I think about transparency to source, if you have an animal that just eats grass and leaves, an herbivore, it's eating directly from the land, you could say it's eating directly from the source of its food. It's not like with a carnivore, say a wolf who eats a lamb who eats the grass. Like, what is the source of the wolf's food? On some level, the source really is the grass, right? Like, the grass provides the nutrition for the lamb, and the lamb provides the nutrition for the wolf. But the wolf isn't eating the grass directly. You don't see the grass going into the wolf's mouth. The wolf is kind of opaque to its real food source. I mean, look, if you want to get philosophical about it, like, yes, the plant is just sourcing its nutrition from somewhere else. But, you know, it's like drawing nutrients up through the soil, dot, dot, dot. But I don't know. I think there is a symbolism there that resonates. I don't exactly know how that ties into transparency to God. Like, how does an herbivore make you more aware of God? I think I need your help making that leap.
Yeah, I think it would be a whole lot more elegant if you could somehow be more aware that these animals, based on what they eat, are more connected to God. And what I'm emphasizing is transparency to source, right? That you can tell that these animals are more connected to the land. But I think that in the Torah's world, that's fairly equivalent, right? We are the children of God, but we are the children of God through the land. We are Bnei Adam. We are the children of the earth, and we derive our sustenance from the earth. And I think that the more connected we are to the earth, the more we understand our source, the more we appreciate that everything really comes from God. I think that the Torah sort of expects us to see the earth as this conduit for spirituality or connectedness to God. But I think if you're thinking about it in terms of tahara as transparency to source or connectedness to source, then it does click.
It feels a little bit mystical for me, but I think I'm sort of coming around to it in my own way. Is it transparency to God? Is it transparency to source? I think there's a way you can see them really as the same thing. It's like the power of this symbolism is that when you start seeing things in terms of source, then the kind of like logical or spiritual extension of that is, well, God is the ultimate source of everything, ultimately, right? Like, once you start thinking about source, it all just traces back to God. That's where your mind goes.
And what's incredible is that these animals, animals that chew their cud and have split hooves, the ones whose sustenance comes directly from grass and leaves. It's not just that these animals are not death-like. It's that these animals are tahor. They are transparent.
They're testifying. They are reminding us. They're drawing our awareness back to God, back to the creator of the world.
Exactly. I actually think there's almost like a biological way in which they are tahor, they are transparent. They have a really interesting relationship to light itself. And here I'll tell you what my ninth grade science teacher, Mr. Fitzgerald, told us that kind of blew our minds in class, which is that the source of all calories in the human diet is the sun. Plants have this incredible ability. They have photosynthesis. They have this ability to take the sun's energy and its rays and convert it into sugar, which gives them their fuel for life. The vegetables are consumed by the animals, and then we consume the animals. We talk about being directly connected to source. Things that eat animals are actually interruptions in their connection to source. And we're not arguing that that light is God. That's just, you know, the natural way in which God provides energy for humanity. But what the Torah is doing here is saying, if you're not going to be eating plants and be as connected to source as you possibly can be,
then the least you can do is one step removed from that, so to speak.
Correct. You cannot eat carnivorous animals. You cannot eat animals that are getting their sustenance from animals who might be getting their sustenance from other animals in turn. And then someone along that chain chose to eat some vegetation, which is the closest we can get to a source in this world, to Earth, to the sun.
Wow. Wow. This is really powerful for me, especially what you said about Mr. Fitzgerald, your science teacher, is really sticking with me. This notion that the sun, it's sort of the closest that we can get to seeing ourselves as being directly sustained by God. Like God set the sun in the solar system, turned on that lamp, it shines down upon the earth, its rays come down to the ground, and it's by that means that everything that nourishes me comes to be. So when God asks me to eat these animals and not those animals, it's because they eat the grass, which eats the sun, so to speak. You know, it eats the light that God is beaming down upon us. And I know perfectly well that the sun's rays, you know, rationally aren't any more God than the grass or the cow, but it sure feels that way. So when I sit down to eat a hamburger, I'm meant to feel that God is feeding me. It's all supposed to bring me back to the awareness of that fundamental reality, which is, at the end of the day, isn't God providing all of our nourishment?
Mm-hmm.
I have this really evocative image in my mind right now, which kind of doesn't make much sense, but I also really want to share it with you, which is, it's as if God is inviting us to experience our eating in this world as, oh, you're hungry? Just step outside. Step outside, look up at the sky, open your mouth, and just drink in the sunlight. And just have the sense that what I, God, am beaming down upon you is all you need.
What I thought was elegant about this is it takes us back to our season opener. Like, it takes us back to our first Kashrus episode.
Wow.
We showed that it's not ideal to eat meat.
But for a whole different reason. I mean, back then we were talking about not eating meat from the perspective of how are we not honoring the life of the animal when we do that. But this is another angle, which is how are we not honoring the creator when we do it?
I don't see this as another angle at all. I see this as directly connected. If we talk about Tahara as your ability to be transparent, to be directly connected to source, and if you see the world around you as transparent and directly connected to source, the last thing you're able to do is kill another being. If you understand that we both have a creator, I have no greater role than you. I can't kill you because it suits me to kill you, right? We both are emanations of the same creator. You know, we both have a role in this movie. For me to see myself in a way in which I have some greater role, or that you serve me in some greater way, that is tamei. That means you're taking your role in the movie way too seriously. You actually see yourself as having a life of your own in this world, not directly connected to our shared creator, to our shared source. And so God says, okay, animals you can eat, but when you eat animals, there is a ritual where you return the blood, your common blood, to the earth. Man has blood, humans have blood. You are both created of the earth. You return the blood to the earth. The earth brings forth life in the sense that it gives us plants, both animal and humanity is created from the earth, and we restore the blood to the earth.
Wait. Let me slow you down. You're saying that kisui dam, the mitzvah, that when we are shechting an animal, not all animals, but many kinds of animals, wild animals, birds, the Torah instructs us to spill the blood on the ground and cover it up. And when we do that, it's actually a way of promoting tahara, because it's a ritual that symbolically reminds us of the animal's source, the earth, either because the earth provides food for the animal, so it's its source in that way, or sort of in this mythical sense, like because the Torah describes that in creation, animals were created from the earth. So really this value of eating betahara that we're discovering seems to be at the heart of the laws of kosher and non-kosher animals. That the very same value also seems to be at the heart of the laws of shechita, of how we slaughter animals.
Exactly. And it reminds me of, you know, our second kashrus episode where we talked about milk and meat. The milk that comes from this animal, right, you need to recognize its source, which is mother of animal, and you cannot consume the two together. These kashrus laws that we've been talking about, to me, all seem to be pointing to in the same direction, which is the recognition of source.
It's a kind of grand unifying theme behind all of the kashrut laws. Emu, don't take this the wrong way, because I loved this. I loved this, and I genuinely think that what you shared is fresh and really exciting and has the potential to be meaningful to a lot of people, myself included. But also, it didn't escape me that there are some topics that we didn't touch upon at all. And you admitted to this, right, when we started to get into this section. Like, I still want to know about kosher and non-kosher birds. How do they fit into this? Fish, the scales, the fins. I think there's more to the story of why we need to have two signs for the land animals and how those signs interact. And you can ask, why does the Torah specifically call out animals that have just one sign and not the other, like the pig and the camel and the hyrax, the hare? So I know we don't have time in this episode to deal with all of those fascinating questions. For anyone who's listening who's curious, we're going to have an epilogue coming to try to speak to some of them, right?
Yep, but also to kind of give you a peek into some of the scholarship that went behind, you know, all the work in this episode.
I have a lot of respect for those amongst us who are willing to put a theory out there, because it takes courage doing it knowingly in the face of holes. But it is the only way that we're going to get any closer to meaning. Thanks for showing us how you put the pieces together and then just being transparent about some of its weaknesses.
If you weren't going to do the transparent joke, I was going to do the transparent joke.
You can still do the transparent joke.
Yeah, the idea here is to be transparent to our source material and to say, you know, this is what I'm seeing in the text. And I hope that you find it compelling and meaningful.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you for taking this journey with me.
Should we break for lunch?
This episode was recorded by me, Emu Shalev, and Beth Lesh. The scholars for this episode were me, with original scholarship by David Block and Ari Levison. The senior editor was Beth Lesh, with additional editing by Sarah Penso. Our audio editor is Hilary Gutman. Our managing producer is Adina Blaustein. Meaningful Judaism's editorial director is me, Imu Shalev. Thank you for listening.